Thank you. Please be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in the interest of A.V. and J.V.
May it please the court, Mr. James Kiley will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
My name is James Wyland. I'm an assistant criminal district attorney from McLennan County, Texas. And in this case, I represent the Texas Department of Protective and Regulatory Services. I'll refer to it as the department. The other parties in this case are the children, AZ and JV, that are named in the suit, and their natural father, Pablo Puig, is the respondent. After a jury trial, the trial court terminated the parent-child relationship between Puig and the children. Puig appealed. The Court of Appeals reversed on three grounds. I'm going to ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals on each of those grounds. First, the Court of Appeals reached a charge complaint raised for the first time on appeal. The court held that the disjunctive charge by which the trial court submitted the termination issue did not provide due process to the parents. The court reached that issue, as I say, for the first time on appeal following its precedent in a case called, in the interest of JFC, a case in which this court heard argument last month. Second, the Court of Appeals held that one of the grounds of termination on which the trial court charged the jury, that is the imprisonment ground, Family Code Section 161.001 sub 1 sub Q, was unconstitutionally retroactive as applied to Puig. Third, the court held that there was no evidence of the other ground of termination, constructive abandonment.
You have to prevail on all three of those arguments, do we?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but it becomes somewhat convoluted very quickly. The first ground that I mentioned, the disjunctive charge, I think is entirely distinct and separate from the other two. But the other two become intertwined. Because, first, as to the retroactivity of the imprisonment ground, that really, as the Court of Appeals analyzes it, is simply a free-floating holding. It's not tied to any action of the trial court.
Let's look at the statutory provision that's at issue there. You take the position that the applicable time period for Q begins to run from the date pleading is filed. So it's a prospective view of the time for imprisonment.
That's correct.
And on what do you hang your hat to support that conclusion?
I believe that's the plain language of the statute.
Well, it says 2 years from the date of filing.
Yes.
And that's the prospective view.
From the date of filing.
But how would that work? Looking at imprisonment prospectively, he's not imprisoned for that time period. You
yes,
have
Your
to attach the imprisonment.
I think the record shows that he was imprisoned well before the time that the petition seeking termination was filed. He was imprisoned at that time, and by his testimony, uncontroverted testimony, he would not be eligible for release until June of next year.
Well, what would happen if the statute means a prospective application? What's going to happen in the absence of testimony that the parent would definitively be in prison for that 2 year period of time? Someone's in prison, but their case is up on appeal.
Well,
and then we're going to terminate their parental rights because they've got this long sentence, and in the midst of it, then there's a reversal of the conviction. Then what happens?
Those are problems of proof, and in some cases, it is not going to be possible to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the parent is going to be incarcerated for 2 years in the future.
So, in other words, if there's an appeal pending, then the state would not be able to rely upon that provision?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
If the appeal is pending, or in a state case, for instance, in which parole is always a possibility, there could be expert testimony from a parole officer. I suppose that would support. And there are cases in which.
So you're saying that it is prospective, but the state's just going to have to be careful and not use this provision in all cases except where it can be definitively determined that the person will absolutely be incarcerated for the next 2 years.
Well, I would say not absolutely, but the standard of proof in these cases is, of course, by clear and convincing evidence. So that's the degree of proof that
So you could depose the governor and ask if he was planning on issuing a pardon?
Well, I'm not sure the governor is even an expert in that. The Board of Pardon and Paroles becomes involved first. But either expert testimony from a parole officer or from a member of the Board of Pardon and Paroles would be sufficient to establish when a given inmate becomes eligible for release. And if that date is 2 years in the future, I don't think there's a problem with the proof.
Why shouldn't we use the same standard for reviewing charge error in these cases that is used in criminal cases, the egregious harm?
Well, I think that there is a problem with the way that the Court of Appeals analyzes this case. It sometimes applies the criminal standard and sometimes applies the civil standard. Now, I don't see any principled basis for that distinction. But the court tries to base everything on constitutional basis, and the procedure for review of the charge in criminal cases is not based on constitutional reasoning. It's based on an interpretation of the statute, Article 36.19 of the Code of Criminal Procedure.
So it's just pure state procedure.
Which is entirely a statutory procedure.
And the egregious harm rule for charge error, for unpreserved charge error in criminal cases is not constitutionally mandated.
It is not. The Court of Criminal Appeals case that interprets Article 36.19 is Almanzo v. State. I don't believe that I cite that in my briefs, but it's 686 Southwest 2nd, 157, on rehearing from the Court of Criminal Appeals in 1985. And that sets up the interpretation of Article 36.19 by which if a defendant objects to the charge of trial, then in order to get reversal on appeal, only has to show some harm, any degree of harm. But if the defendant does not object at trial, then on appeal has to show that he has not had a fair and impartial trial, that it has to show egregious harm. And the Court of Criminal Appeals has repeatedly held that egregious harm is an extremely difficult standard to meet.
But a misstatement of the elements would meet. A misstatement of the elements of the offense.
A misstatement of the elements of the offense even may or may not be sufficient. The court looks to the charge as a whole and the state of the evidence and the argument of counsel primarily to determine whether there was harm or egregious harm.
Looking at the other provision in that was the ground given to the jury, the Court of Appeals determined that there was not any evidence of one of the required elements of that ground.
That's right.
When would the state ever be able to offer evidence that the department or authorized agency has made reasonable efforts to return the children to the parent when the parent is incarcerated?
I think that we did put on evidence in this case that we made all reasonable efforts to return the children.
And what was that?
That we determined that he was in prison. And that it was not possible to return the children to.
But this says that has to have made reason. If it's not possible to return, then doesn't it make it impossible to ever prove that particular element of the ground, and therefore this is an invalid ground for termination of an incarcerated parent?
I don't think so. I think that it's possible to conclusively prove that we've made reasonable efforts to return the children.
Effort means we didn't do anything because he was incarcerated?
Reasonable efforts means what's reasonable under the circumstances. And under these circumstances, it's not possible to return the children.
So that writes that element out of this particular ground whenever a parent is incarcerated.
I think it means that it's established as a matter of law.
You're saying, but that's conclusive proof that there were reasonable efforts, which means there was some effort made. You're saying that it was conclusively established that we didn't have to do anything because the person was incarcerated.
Well, we didn't have to do anything other than determine that he was incarcerated. I think after that point...
If I disagree with you on that and say that the state can't ever prove that with an incarcerated person, then does this make this an invalid ground for an incarcerated parent?
No, I don't think so.
What does it make it then?
If you disagree with it, I'm not sure what it makes it, but I think what you should believe is that whenever whenever the proof shows the elements of the cause of action, that cause of action lies in that case.
Okay, well, assume with me that there isn't any evidence of that. And given our interpretation of that provision, there couldn't ever be any evidence of it. Because you're not going to return children or make an effort to return them if their parent is incarcerated. If that's the case, then is this a valid ground for termination that can be used against a parent who is incarcerated?
On the premise that there can never be any proof of that element, that I don't see an alternative, whether the parent is incarcerated or whether there's some other reason for which the children can't be returned to the parent, I don't see how the state could prove that cause of action.
Does that make it an invalid ground then? Or a legally inapplicable ground or something to that effect?
It would be one in which the proof simply fails.
The subpart N also, it has a series of things that have to be satisfied as elements, and it's all connected by and one of those is that they haven't maintained significant contacts with the children or regular visits. Don't they have family visits in prison or not? I mean, don't mothers get to see their children if they're incarcerated? Can you just assume that you can satisfy N just because they're incarcerated without proof that they would not be entitled through their incarceration to maintain significant contacts with the children or regular visits with the children?
The proof in this case was that, as to your question about the family in general, that when Puig was incarcerated near where the family lived, that the mother at least did, and perhaps the children, when they were in the mother's care, didn't go and visit him, that later when he was moved to a different facility, that they were not able to do that. When the children came into the department's care, the department's policy is not to have visitation.
But I raised the question under N, can you satisfy the reasonable attempts by simply saying the person's incarcerated without dealing with the issues of family visitation at prison?
I think in this case the proof was that Puig was able to send letters to the children, and that he did on one occasion in some 7 years. Now, I argued in the Court of Appeals that that was sufficient to maintain contact. And at the time of this trial, the statute read only to maintain contact with the children, not a significant contact, I believe.
Mr. Ollie, are you aware of any legislative history that would help us interpret N and Q?
I cite some legislative history in my reply brief, but really only to the point of only to show that the purpose of both of those statutes was for the protection of children. But as to details of how to interpret them, as to what the 2-year period means, and whether an imprisoned parent can have his rights terminated under these statutes, no, I'm not aware of any legislative history.
Because, I mean, it's clear that constructive abandonment deals with the foster care setting, the constructive abandonment piece, because it only applies if the child has been taken into custody by the Department of Protective and Regulatory Services.
Yes. Or some other authorized agency.
Right.
Let me return to Q just for a second. You said a while ago that under the clear and convincing evidence standard, if the state were to prove that the parent would be incarcerated for a minimum of 2 years with that standard, then that would support termination under Q.
Yes, sir.
What would happen if that case were made, but nevertheless the parent was on appeal acquitted during that 2 years? What would happen? And termination had occurred.
I believe that if a parent were incarcerated pending appeal, then surely the parent's counsel would raise that at trial.
Well, what is, I'm trying to figure out, what is the standard of clear and convincing? When could the state show, without arguing the whole appeal, that the parent would remain for 2 years in prison?
The question of appeal, I think, is more difficult than just the question of the length of imprisonment before eligibility for parole. If a parent has given notice of appeal and the appeal is pending during the termination suit, I think it's going to be very difficult to prove by clear and convincing evidence.
Would it be impossible, I guess, is what I'm asking.
No, I don't think it would be impossible. I think one can bring in
We're talking about a very important right here, and of course the state's going to argue, well, there's no way this person will ever be released, the evidence is conclusive against him, et cetera, et cetera. But then on appeal, if notice of appeal has been filed, you know, someone who's representing him is going to say, well, there's plenty of ground. And there's going to be a case where, even though it looks like, from the state's perspective, maybe the judges, that the incarceration will occur for 2 years, that the Court of Appeals will find error and reverse and release him from prison. I'm just trying to find out when, you know, there will be a case where there's a termination under your view and a later acquittal, and a parent who was found not to be guilty will have lost the rights to his or her.
I still think there are going to be cases in which it is possible to prove by clear and convincing evidence. For instance, you can bring in a lawyer to testify that the appeal is frivolous. But apart from something like that, I think that a jury probably should not believe by clear and convincing evidence if a bona fide appeal is pending that the parent is going to be convicted and incarcerated for 2 years.
Was error preserved as to the complaints about N being included in the jury charge?
That too is somewhat confused, Your Honor. The parents did make a motion for a directed verdict at the close of the department's case, but then I believe waived it by putting on their evidence. The parents then, or Puig did then, raise in a motion for a new trial, the no evidence point on N. And so, in that regard, I think the Court of Appeals erred in rendering for Puig on N. If it was, as I believe, preserved only by a motion for new trial, then the only remedy can be remand.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Nita Fanning will present argument for the respondent.
In this case, the 10th Court followed other courts that have made similar decisions across the state. In RAT out of Eastland, the court addressed the same kind of retroactive type statutes, and the 10th Court followed their lead, which in the interim had been followed by the El Paso court in Shaw.
Well, isn't a court, though, required to... It seems to me the Waco court went backwards. It gave an interpretation to the statute that it then declared was unconstitutional. Aren't you required to give an interpretation to a statute that keeps it constitutional? If Waco had said, this is prospective, that Q only applies prospectively to sentences that are more than 2 years, 2 years or more, on the date of filing the petition for termination. If they had interpreted it that way, then they would not have reached the constitutional question, would they? It wouldn't have been retroactive.
I believe that they felt like they were, my reading was, they felt like they were following the decisions that had already been addressed in ALS and Shaw.
But then that required them to declare it unconstitutional by interpreting it that way, and they certainly weren't bound to read it that way.
Well, after those cases came down, then the El Paso court also decided ALS, which also which reviewed RAT out of Eastland, its own Shaw case, the Waco case, and said it looks to us like, particularly in light of the way that the state has ordered the shorter term, the deadline statutes now, that if you don't go backwards and start it and anytime you do it prospectively, you're almost going to run afoul of the deadlines, because your petition has got to be filed and go to trial within a year or 18 months, and so you'd never reach the 2 year position, or it would even be more tenuous, I guess. So simply just because of the shortening of the time limits now since RAT and since Shaw, it becomes more difficult.
But
to
you don't have to, you don't have to file the petition I mean, there's no time frame about when it has to be filed.
Correct.
It just, one of the grounds could be when it's filed that the sentence will be lasting more than 2 years. So it could be filed a year after the conviction. It could be filed 2 years after the conviction that you're terminating from, couldn't it? I mean, there's nothing that requires you to file immediately just upon the conviction.
Correct. The problem, too, that that ran afoul in Waco was simply that it was a new statute and that there just wasn't time from the time that the statute was enacted to go back those 2 years. And the court, I believe it was ARR in Fort Worth, looked at it. And in that case, the respondent tried to claim the same thing that Pablo Puig did. The problem there was, and the court found, no, it was not retroactive as to him because his petition was not filed until more than 2 years after the enactment of the statute.
Fanning, would you explain to us the analysis that supports your interpretation of Q? Because I understand you view the 2 years should come before the date of the filing of the petition as opposed to looking at it prospectively.
That's correct, Your Honor. Simply because by that time, I think the ALS probably looks at it more clearly than I do, but I think their analysis was by that time, if you look at it, if you go backwards, you're much more likely to have a sure conviction. Most of the appellate problems, is he going to really be in prison for longer? At that point, you know he has been in prison for 2 years. So
that's... Can you square that with the language, the before language, though?
I'm sorry, the...
How do you square that with the use of the words from the date of filing the petition?
I think the commentators have just said that is a problem. But, I mean, they've said that's a problem, and the best solution is, if it's going to be from one way or another, you run into a lot of problems if you apply it prospectively. You speculate on whether he's going to be incarcerated 2 years, plus you run afoul of CPS's own deadlines. They've got to get him terminated before 2 years, so you just don't have time to play it out.
But the other way, you have to wait. Fellow's convicted of murder or something. So then you'd have to wait 2 years before you could even file. And then you'd have to wait the time it takes to get the case tried, which from our vantage point looks like it's taken about a year almost in a lot of cases.
And I can tell the court that at this point, since the new, since last year when they changed the appellate rules, that stopped down a whole lot.
But aren't they running up? They're bumping up against the one-year deadline pretty regularly.
Right.
But it seems to me when they, in other sections of the statute, when they were talking about time periods before the filing, they clearly said so, and they were very specific, and they used different language in Q.
I can just point to the court to say this is just a problem. It's not been clear, and I think that the courts have analyzed it have said, look, it's not clear. We don't know, but we've our best, looking at this from the angles that we can look at it, the best thing seems to be to not do it prospectively, but to look backwards.
Let's think through that, though. Let's suppose that I'm in prison for petty theft for 2 years, and I'm about to be released, and termination proceedings are brought against me, and I'm about to get out, whereas if I had been convicted of murder, as Judge Heck said, and I'm in for life, you would have to wait 2 years before you could bring termination proceedings. That's what that seems sort of backwards.
I think it does. In that case, that'd be a difficult case, and hopefully the jury would say maybe it's not in the best interest. In another case, in D.T., also, I believe out of Fort Worth, the court looked at this and they kept saying, well, look, it looks like she might be in jail for 7 years, but she might not. She had a lot of misdemeanor hot check charges, I think. And they were in different states. And they said, look, number one, and this kind of addresses both of them, abandonment is just not, being in prison is just not a reason for abandonment. But they just didn't want to speculate on the fact that she wasn't going to be out of, going to be in prison that long. And they said, it, for them, they just didn't think it was sufficient evidence.
They, if you say that this statute is to be read to mean that this 2 years has to occur prior, before the filing, or you have to have as a threshold to get the termination, actually having been incarcerated for 2 years, then, but, I mean, then what is the value of that one? Wouldn't, if you're looking at the history, wouldn't abandonment have occurred long before 2 years? Wouldn't, I mean, you would, well, how would you ever bring this claim for termination because they were incarcerated for 2 years when the elements of abandonment would have been proved before then?
Number one, I think the Tenth Court addresses the fact that neither N nor Q are necessary to terminate parents who are incarcerated. By virtue of the fact that they committed an act which resulted in their incarceration.
Well, that begs the question. If Q refers to history, then I agree with the Court of Appeals that they don't need it. But if Q refers to the future, then in those cases where there isn't an appeal pending, or certainly not a question about the sentence, then they can bring termination immediately while the children are young without worrying about waiting for 2 years. So it makes a significant difference on the value of Q in custody, the best interests of a child, if it's applied prospectively, and makes no difference in the best interest of the child if it's applied in the past.
I think that the courts probably, if they didn't say so directly, they might have been looking at the balancing acts between the rights of the parents and the best interest of the children and the risk of error. And I think that's probably part of the balancing act that got them to looking at applying it prospectively. Just that they're, you know, it may solve the problem for the children, but it may not address the rights of the parents, and it may not, the risk of error may be so great that
what is
that may overcome.
Suppose it may be problematic for the state to bring a claim for termination based on the conviction with a sentence of greater than 2 years early in that process. But it's entirely possible that there's enough indication to the state that this is a person who's going away for a long time. The likelihood of them having a merit-filled appeal is insignificant. This is a person who has not demonstrated from their records any sort of interest in the kids. And these kids are 18 months old, they're 1 year old. Let's bring it now. We think we've got clear and convincing evidence that'll support termination. Let's put it out there and let's get this done in 6-7 months and get these children in a position of perhaps being adopted. How does that weigh against some of the commentators saying, well, this is problematic because you don't know what happens on appeal? Couldn't the legislature have chosen to go for running that kind of risk being problematic on appeal, but in favor of, in the majority of cases where the state would have the discretion to file in this when they know this person's going away for a while and he's got some young kids and it's going to be too late 2 years from now to get him adopted? I mean,
in all likelihood, he would have, there would be other grounds that he would have committed that would have been available other than Q. It would be my response. And I don't mean to dodge that question, but he may likely be a good candidate for N, where if he's out of prison during some of the time that you're talking about when the children were young, then, and they were in custody, then he may well have not cooperated with CPS. He may well have not visited the children. But again, I would urge that N is a ground that's that's something for people who are out of jail. That's not a ground for parents who are incarcerated.
Your view is that it's an invalid or inapplicable ground to an incarcerated parent?
It is. I believe the 10th Court said that it would be redundant to cue.
Well, Mr. Wiley says that it has to be reasonable efforts to return. And if it's not reasonable to return a child to a parent who's incarcerated, then they've met their burden under the first element. What's your response to that?
Well, I believe their testimony was that they had made no effort. And that
he says that's what's reasonable. No
right.
effort makes a reasonable effort.
Well, it would seem to be no evidence then on a ground, but that would be my interpretation. And again, there's so many ways to do this other than to try to squish this square peg into that round hole.
Are you familiar with any legislative history to either of these provisions that would help us interpret them?
From what I've read, Your Honor, it appears that CPS had for years been wanting a ground that when parents didn't cooperate with them, they could say, well, that's just enough. They got that almost in subsection O, which says if they don't follow an order of the court. Kind of the interim provision they got, I believe, was N, that said, well, if the children are in custody. So this was kind of the interim ground that the legislature gave in I believe, 1995. But again,
so this was designed to deal with parents' conduct
who did not follow the plan.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
But what if you have someone that's in prison and the department goes in and said, do you have parents or friends that you've made arrangements with to take this child while you're in prison? The person says no, and hasn't made any effort. Why wouldn't or couldn't or shouldn't N apply under those circumstances?
Well, again, CPS is always going to fail on its efforts to reunite because if you assume that they can't make any effort to reunite them or they can't make a plan, in this case there was a plan.
The reasonable effort would be some obligation on the department's part to go to the incarcerated person and say, do you have a spouse or a family member or a friend who's willing to take custody or who will keep this child for you? And then the incarcerated person says, no, and I haven't made any effort, doesn't write, doesn't call. Why shouldn't N apply under those circumstances? I mean, you seem to be saying don't ever apply N to the incarcerated person. It seems to me there could be circumstances where it should.
There's so many other grounds that we have applied to people who are incarcerated. It just doesn't seem like we need to strain so hard to apply it in this particular one where there are conjunctive things that have to be proved. In addition, another problem with this is, as I said, in this case, the children did go to see him in prison, and he did communicate with them while they were in their mom's possession. However, once CPS got custody of the children, they stopped all that visitation because their policy is, and they will tell you, they do not want children taken to prison. They will not do that. So they kind of...
But significant contact can include letters, phone calls. It wouldn't have to include...
It could, but the phone call issue was a real problem here. He apparently called a lot and... would call CPS, try to even call the workers, and that's a difficult thing in prison. You can't call 10 times a day, probably. But that was a difficult thing. And he did communicate through another child of his that was an intermediary between them. It's a hard thing, but it just, again, there's so many cases where D or E have been applied to parents who've been incarcerated simply because, by default, when they got incarcerated, they left the kids with somebody who endangered them. And so that took care of it. There are other grounds that apply in these cases. We just, it just seems like that's really kind of just fit with the wrong facts for that.
These two boys are approaching 17 and 15.
This person.
And they're in foster care.
Yes, sir.
And have been for nearly a decade.
Since, I believe, so since 97.
Oh, since 97. Well, he went to prison in 93.
Correct. And they were with the mother until 97, I believe.
And then, and her rights are terminated, and she's not contesting that.
That's correct.
And the child who is mentally retarded, the younger,
correct.
Is he in any special care? Or any?
Yes. They have a special, I believe there are levels of care, and I addressed part of that in my brief, Your Honor. There are levels of care that go from 1 to 6, is my understanding. He is, therapeutic care already is at level 4, and he has an IQ of about 40, and it's my understanding he isn't able to explore himself.
I think your brief says he might go to 5.
Right. I kind of assumed that he might be at either 5 or 6, probably closer to 5. this seems to be a father from his deposition that cares a lot about his kids, and he had made a misguided attempt to escape to take care of them, which is, you know, certainly unsuccessful and put him farther in the hole. But the older child expressed a distinct wish to not be terminated. And then the younger child is the one who's retarded, and it just seems to be a case where maybe termination just isn't the best solution in this case. And
what is the practical effect of terminating a parental rights to a 17-year-old who doesn't want to be terminated?
And he's in a good place. The foster mother, in the record that I saw, said that, you know, she wanted to keep him, and he wanted to stay there, from his testimony. So I'm not sure what this would really solve, but there were probably
other ways.
Well,
except we've got a court of appeals that declared the statute unconstitutional, don't we?
I think it was an unconstitutional application in this sense, because as to Mr. Puig, it applied it in a retroactive manner.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Wiley, were there other grounds for termination that apply to the facts of this case, as reflected in the record?
Your Honor, I don't think that. I think that there were other grounds that, as the evidence came out at trial, that the department might have alleged but did not know about until preparation for trial. I say that because
it just seems curious that we have two grounds that there's so much debate over, with all the grounds that are listed in the statute.
I think that as the evidence came out at trial, the D&E grounds for endangerment would have been applicable. But I don't see any evidence in the record from the early petitions and the review hearings in the case that we knew about that.
Well, I'm confused about that. The state was putting its case on, so all that came in through your case, I would take it. I wouldn't have thought that the parent would have put on evidence of endangerment, so the state found out about its case as it was putting it on?
It came, I say that as I say, since I don't see any evidence of that in the record early on in the case. But at trial, we put on a Texas Ranger who investigated Puig for distribution of cocaine, and he testified about that the children lived with Puig while he was selling cocaine. He kept guns, and kept the cocaine in the house, and that, for instance, they went to retrieve the cocaine.
All that would have been available to the state before trial.
It was available.
Say we found out about it during trial, and I was confused by that.
Well, I think I don't see anywhere in the record. I didn't try this case, but I don't see anywhere in the record that we alleged any of that until trial. So I'm presuming from that we became aware of it when talking to that witness and preparing for trial. Otherwise, I don't see any reason not to allege endangerment of the children. Justice Owen, I wanted to answer your question about contacts with the spouse or other family members. If those constitute reasonable efforts to return the children to the parent, then those were made in this case, because First, after the children were removed from their mother's care, they were put in the care of an aunt, and then after a few months, she became unable to take care of them anymore. That's when they were removed from the home. After that, the department conducted home studies on Puig's wife, that is not the mother of these children, but is another woman to whom he was married, and it was determined that that was not a suitable home for the children to live in. So we did make attempts in that regard to place the children not with Puig, but with members of his family at his request, and those attempts failed. I just want to state again that I think that the questions of the possibility of reversal on appeal or early release on parole are problems of proof that will arise in some cases but not in others. And in this case, they simply do not arise. Puig was convicted in 1993 based on his plea of guilty. He waived appeal. Even if he wanted to file appeal, the time for filing appeal had long passed by trial in 2000. There was no doubt, based on his uncontradicted testimony, that he would not be even eligible for release for 3 more years after trial. So those concerns...
If you win this case, there are still issues that remain in the Court of Appeals that would have to be decided, so this is a remand to the Court of Appeals. Is that correct?
I would urge the Court, in the interest of the speedy resolution of this case involving child custody, to decide it.
All those issues have not been brought up here. Court of Appeals opinion mentions a list of issues that it chose not to reach because of its resolution. It did not need to reach because of its resolution of the case, and none of those are briefed here. We don't even know what they are.
Well, I'll tell you what they are, and if the Court wants briefing on those issues, I'll be glad to brief them. They're very simple, and the Court can dispose of them very easily. Those are, may I finish?
Please.
Those are the form of the verdict form and the form of the judgment. As to the form of the verdict form, Puig made no objection to that at trial, so he waived it. As to the form of the judgment, Puig not only didn't object to that at trial, he affirmatively approved it as to form by signing the judgment and therefore affirmatively waived it. So I think the Court should resolve
those
issues.
Are there any other issues?
I believe those are the only issues. Those, as they were framed in the Court of Appeals, they may be divided into more... they may be denominated as more issues than that, but I believe those are, in fact, the only two questions.
The jury was instructed on both N and Q in accordance with the statutory language for those provisions. And obviously we've been debating today what Q means in terms of the time period. Did the jury have any question about what that provision meant during its deliberations?
I don't recall the jury sending out any notes, but I'm not sure.
How was the case tried?
In what regard?
In other words, what kind of proof did the state offer to meet the 2-year imprisonment requirement?
The proof was Puig's testimony by deposition, that he was in prison, that he had been in prison for 7 years, and that he would not be released for 3 more years. We also introduced copies of the judgments.
Did the state argue to the jury to look at the 2 years prospectively, or did the state look retrospectively?
I don't recall anything.
I'd like to hear from Ms. Fanning just very briefly on what the other issues not briefed in the Court of Appeals were, not addressed by the Court of Appeals were. Do you agree with opposing counsel's?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
Thank you, counsel.
How was the case tried from your standpoint, prospectively or retrospectively?
I don't believe it was identified. I believe that it stated the day that he was incarcerated and the day that he was released.
Thank you, counsel. That completes the argument in the third. Calls will take another brief recess.
All rise.